From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, Osama bin Laden's organization released a videotape in which a spokesperson promised that the storm of airplanes will not stop. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the video with Jeffrey Goldberg, who writes about the Middle East for The New Yorker. We'll also talk about Goldberg's recent article on how Egyptian intellectuals responded to the attacks of September 11th. And we'll hear about Goldberg's visit to the extremist religious school in Pakistan, which has graduated more leaders of the Taliban than any other school. Also today, reactions in Pakistan to the bin Laden organization's video and to the American bombing of Afghanistan. We talk with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's the author of a book about the Taliban. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The U.S. has begun a fourth night of airstrikes over Afghanistan. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Faizawad in northern Afghanistan.
Taliban anti-aircraft defenses fire into the night sky as warplanes roar over the Afghan capital, Kabul. Witnesses say they've heard explosions coming from the direction of Kabul's airport. A fourth night of U.S. airstrikes has begun. Taliban officials said there were also daytime attacks against the southern city of Kandahar on Wednesday. The Taliban also announced that, quote, Osama is safe and alive. The Afghan government says the world's most wanted man has been released to travel freely. This after the U.S. rejected last week's last-minute offer from the Taliban to try bin Laden in an Afghan court. Meanwhile, Afghanistan's opposition Northern Alliance commanders say they're still waiting to launch a new ground offensive against Taliban positions. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Faizabad in northern Afghanistan.
President Bush today unveiled a new list of 22 most wanted terrorists, including Osama bin Laden. The list is similar to the FBI's 10 most wanted. Officials say the White House is working with the TV program America's Most Wanted on a special broadcast. U.S. TV networks have agreed to screen videotaped messages from Osama bin Laden and his associates before they're aired. Network executives say some may be edited. The move comes after the White House cautioned that bin Laden could be using the videos to send secret coded messages to his operatives. A one-day Islamic conference in Qatar ended today with no formal condemnation of the airstrikes in Afghanistan. The delegates did urge that the strikes be limited and innocent lives be spared. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Taliban foreign minister sent a letter calling the airstrikes in Afghanistan state-sponsored terrorism, and a handful of countries called for condemning the strikes. But the conference instead condemned the September 11th attacks and shared their concerns about what happens next in the region. Pakistan's foreign minister, Abdus Sattar, said one of the many difficult questions is who will be running Afghanistan a year from now.
The peace, stability, and territorial integrity of Afghanistan depends on the capacity of the Afghan people to construct a broad-based, representative, and multi-ethnic government.
But Sattar and his colleagues agree that creating that government will be an extremely delicate proposition. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Doha, Qatar.
Turkey's parliament today approved a plan to offer its troops to the U.S.-led campaign against terrorism. Today's vote came despite polls that indicate up to 80% of the Turkish public is against the U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 188 points to finish at 9240 on volume of 1.3 million shares. The Nasdaq was up 56 points and the S&P 500 rose 24. You're listening to NPR News. President Bush and congressional leaders are discussing ways to recharge the economy. In an interview with NPR, House Democratic leader Richard Gephardt says that all sides want quick action.
The feeling, I think, is that the faster we can get whatever stimulus out there that we're going to put out there so that it can have an effect on the holiday season, all the better.
Gephardt says Democrats are focusing on a new round of income tax rebates for low and middle income workers, while Republican Majority Leader Dick Armey says economic growth must be the only agenda as lawmakers develop the bill. 19 people in Belize and one person in Guatemala were killed after Hurricane Iris slammed into the country's Caribbean coast. 15 Americans are among the dead. Gene Coletta reports from Guatemala City.
The Americans were members of the Richmond Dive Club in Virginia. They were aboard a boat that capsized in the Monkey River about 40 miles north of the Guatemalan border. The hurricane has left between 13,000 and 14,000 people homeless in Belize alone. Vaughn Gill, a spokesman for Belize's prime minister, says efforts now turn to preventing disease spread by the lack of sanitation and safe drinking water. Preliminary numbers estimate the hurricane caused about $250 million in damage. However, officials say that number could double once they assess all the damage. Iris was a Category 4 hurricane with winds of up to 140 miles per hour. For NPR News, I'm Gene Coletta in Guatemala City.
Emergency crews and residents began cleaning up today after a series of tornadoes whipped across the plains. The twisters damaged more than 100 homes and left tons of debris. Five people, including one infant, were treated for injuries from flying glass and debris. Most of the damaged homes were in Cordell, Oklahoma. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual Financial Group, a global diversified financial services organization with more than $220 billion in assets under management, on the web at massmutual.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, Osama bin Laden's organization released a videotape in which a spokesperson said that Americans must know that the storm of airplanes will not stop, and that the battle will not leave its land until, quote, America leaves our land, until it stops supporting Israel, until it stops the blockade against Iraq. My guest Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker and is currently writing a book on the Middle East. He's also written for The New York Times Magazine and The Jerusalem Post. This morning I spoke with him about the Al-Qaeda videotape and the subjects of two of Goldberg's pieces, his visit to a madrasa, an extremist religious school in Pakistan, and how Egyptian intellectuals were responding to terrorism in America. Although on the videotape, Al-Qaeda may not directly claim responsibility for the attacks of September 11th, it does, at the very least, endorse the attacks. Goldberg met several intellectuals in Egypt who didn't think bin Laden could be behind the attacks. They believed alternate scenarios.
Well, one of the scenarios that was racist, I mean, to put it plainly, and I heard this from a number of Muslim leaders, was that Arabs wouldn't be capable of pulling this act off, not for moral reasons, but because, and I, this is a quote, because they can't show up to airplanes on time. They're not coordinated enough to hijack four airplanes simultaneously. I reminded them that Egypt launched a pretty effective surprise attack on Israel in the Yom Kippur War of 1973, and they got all the planes up in the air at the same time. One thing I heard over and over again were, you know, references to something, you know, we here in America think is a kind of a dead letter issue, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. You know, where what's happened is very archaic European forms of anti-Semitism have been adopted wholeheartedly by much of the intellectual class in places like Egypt. So the overwhelming theory that I heard was that the Jews did this. And there were all kinds of proofs offered that Israel told all the Jews in the World Trade Center to stay home on September 11th and things like that. So I heard various forms of that conspiracy. And then the usual, America did it to itself in order to have the excuse to go kill Muslims and that sort of thing. But it was really fascinating, and if I might editorialize, quite depressing to hear this kind of stuff being said, because it was coming from people who have otherwise one would call a fairly good grasp on reality.
Well, somebody who writes op-ed pieces for newspapers told you
not just newspapers, by the way, not just newspapers, but government run newspapers. And remember, the government in Egypt is our ally, the government of Hosni Mubarak. Is ostensibly an American ally, and that to me is more significant than the mere fact that there are newspaper columns being run. These are newspapers whose editors are appointed personally by the president of Egypt.
Okay, well, this person who writes for the government newspapers told you that the World Trade Center attacks were probably done by Branch Davidians, the McVeigh people, with help from the Mossad. That strikes me as a particularly outlandish.
Well, you know, I explain.
Besides, Timothy McVeigh isn't a Branch Davidian. I mean, he doesn't get that either.
You know, the nuances of the American far right escape, you know, even Americans. So I don't expect the Egyptians to get that. But what I do expect the Egyptians to get, and what this guy and some others didn't get, I said at one point, you know, the neo-Nazis in America might actually have an ideological program working with a Jewish intelligence agency. And the response to that was, aha, that shows how clever this conspiracy is, because that's what they want you to think. And at that point, you know, you're kind of you're arguing in a circle, and you just say, I mean, as a reporter, you just kind of open your notebook and say, okay, and, you know, what else do you got? Because there's no arguing with that. But this is what you're faced with. You know, it's interesting. There's a very, very smart Egyptian playwright I sat with one day named Ali Salem, who was an Egyptian peace, one of the few Egyptians left who still advocates for peace with Israel. And he said, you know, the wonderful thing about you Americans is you're trying to understand this situation using logic, but using logic in this case is like trying to measure distance in kilograms. You know, your rational approach, your fact based approach, is not the right tool to try to understand everything that's going on here.
Let me quote something else that this person said to you. You quote him in the New Yorker article that you wrote recently. He said, He said about the attackers, these are people who are afraid of America, afraid of life itself. These are people who are envious. To them, life is an unbearable burden. Modernism is the only way out. But modernism is frightening. It means we have to compete. It means we can't explain everything away with conspiracy theories. What do you think of those comments?
I think they're profound. I think they're profound, and when he was saying this to me, I was brought back very quickly to the last time I was in Afghanistan, which was a year ago, and I spent most of that time in Kandahar, sort of the spiritual capital of the Taliban, which is now being bombed, I think. I was struck by two things about Kandahar. One was something I heard, one was something I saw. The thing I heard, which was so horrifying, was that women are inordinately the victims of car accidents when they're pedestrians, because they're wrapped in these burqas, these head coverings that deny them peripheral vision, so they can't see when they're crossing the street. And so they're hit by cars with a much greater frequency than men are hit by cars, and that was sort of horrifying to me. And that sort of symbolized the place the role women play in that society. The thing I saw that was just so fascinating. When you drive into town, you begin to see you see this kind of thick black ribbon around trees, around tree limbs, around poles. And I couldn't at first identify what this was. And the guy I was with said, it's cassette tape. And I asked him to explain. And he said, well, when the Taliban catches someone listening to music, they arrest the person listening to music, they take the cassettes, and they rip out all the black tape, you know, the thin black tape, and wrap it around trees as a warning to other people not to listen to music. I mean, these are people we're dealing with who hate everything. You know, there's no music, there's no art, there's no drama, there's no acceptance of anything other than the things they decide the Quran accepts. And Afghanistan is obviously an extreme example of this, but you find this through, you know, unfortunately, you find this through, in many pockets of the Muslim world, a fear of the future, a fear of modernity and all that it stands for. And I think what he was saying is fairly profound, because he's saying, look, this is not about Israeli settlements. This is not about Indian policy in Kashmir. This is about jealousy.
Jeffrey Goldberg is my guest. He writes about the Middle East for The New Yorker. You went to a madrasa, which is a religious, an extremist religious school in Pakistan. The one you went to had about 2,800 students, and this was the school, you say, that graduated more leaders of the Taliban than any other school. And in fact, Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, was given an honorary degree. You actually enrolled in this school?
Well, I sort of presented myself one day and met the director of the school. This is on the Grand Trunk Road between Islamabad and Peshawar in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. I presented myself there, and I said, you know, I want to find out what you guys are teaching. And so I spent you know, a bit of time in this institution, and I basically saw how these minds are shaped.
And what year was it that you enrolled?
This is last year.
What's
this is last, 2000.
What was the curriculum at this religious school?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot of art or drama, let me tell you that. there's something that was very fascinating, and that mostly centered on memorization of the Quran and of the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And what's so interesting about this is the memorization was done in Arabic, and Pakistanis and Afghans, these people were mostly pushed on speakers. So these kids, 10 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old, they don't know any Arabic. So they're memorizing a book in a language they don't understand. So when I sat in these classes, I saw over and over again, it was simply a teacher sitting on the floor and the students around him reciting passages from the Quran, and then the students mimicking that recitation. Not a whole lot of deep intellectual inquiry was going on, but you know, one could argue that this is the way that people are brainwashed. I mean, these students, I wouldn't even hesitate to say now that many of the students I met are probably now on the front lines of the Taliban, ready to confront American troops.
My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who's writing a book about the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's writing a book about the Middle East. When we left off, we were talking about the time he spent at a madrasa, an extremist Muslim school in Pakistan. I thought it was interesting. You say some of the students approached you for sex. They propositioned you?
Yeah. And the photographer I was with as well, yeah.
I thought that was so interesting because it's such a sexually repressed society. I mean,
well,
certainly, that's my impression.
They don't see women.
It.
I mean, it's right. A, you know, it's they never see women.
But it's not it's not like they approve of homosexuality.
Oh no! And as a matter of fact, the punishment for homosexuality is death. That said, and you know, I'm no expert on this, but you know, I imagine when you take 2,800 young men and keep them entirely away from women, even their own sisters. But parenthetically, let me mention that I met one young mullah in Kandahar who told me that he hasn't hugged or kissed his mother since he reached puberty because that would be impermissible. So you're dealing with, almost like a prison environment in a kind of way. So it came as some surprise, but not a great surprise. The other thing is that they have, and this goes to the way they view America, they have all kinds of ideas about the way we Americans behave. And the assumption was that we are allowed to be, this is the way it was phrased, we are allowed to be heterosexual and homosexual at the same time. I was asked if American law allows the keeping of boyfriends and girlfriends simultaneously. They expect that in the anything goes American climate that I'd be ready and the photographer I was with, who was French actually, we'd be ready to have sex with everybody. It was one of the more disconcerting aspects of my visit to this madrasa, I must tell you.
I see it actually as a very hopeful sign, in the sense that if they could be taught such sexual repression and still want to approach somebody about having sex, approach them, you know, on the quiet, you know, obviously, and very, very covertly. But still, it means that all of their impulses aren't being killed, that there's still something there, some impulse that wants to express itself in spite of all of the repression. So maybe there's other impulses.
Well, religious fundamentalists have spend most of the time trying to kill the sexual impulse, and religious fundamentalism has always been unsuccessful in killing that sexual impulse. So I guess if I had a little more distance from it, I would probably agree with you.
Did the students seem anxious to want to grow up and become suicide bombers and to die for the cause?
Yeah, you know, in that there was a great similarity. I spent a lot of time in Gaza in particular with would-be suicide bombers. And I noticed a great... it's fascinating when you can go 1,000 miles and hear the same exact words. You know, and I think we actually heard this in the statement yesterday. I heard a lot of, I guess you would call it bluster in a way, these sorts of statements... you know, the difference between us, between Islam and the West is you in the West love life, but we love death. I've heard that in Pakistan, and I've heard it in Gaza. It's a concept that I think gives us at least a sliver of understanding about, you know, what we're facing. I was once in a class, I think I wrote this in the piece, I was asked to... After I hung out there for a while, I was asked to speak to some classes and answer questions, which was a very fascinating thing. And, you know, I would ask things like, who's ready to die for Osama bin Laden? And all the hands would shoot up. And who believes that Osama bin Laden should have nuclear weapons? And everybody would cheer. You know, there's a great amount. I mean, these are teenagers also. And so they're going to swagger a bit. Does that mean that I think they, in fact, don't want to be suicide bombers? I don't know. You know, we'll be finding out, I'm afraid, in the coming days, how committed they are to this particular vision of Islam.
The statement that you've said you've heard repeated, you know, 1,000 miles apart, that Americans want to live for their cause, but Muslims want to die for it. And the echo that it had in yesterday's tape released by the Bin Laden organization was this: the spokesperson said there are thousands of young people who are as keen about death as Americans are about life.
Yeah,
you know that. There's a lot of Muslims who they want to die for the cause.
Well, this is what we're facing in any number of spheres. In one interpretation of the rules of martyrdom, I guess you would say it's considered a holy mission to go sacrifice your own life while killing the infidel. You know, we'll really find out if how committed the Taliban is to this idea.
You made no secret of the fact that you were Jewish while you were visiting this extremist religious school in Pakistan.
It's kind of hard to disguise the name. The Goldberg usually means one thing.
Right. To the students who knew you were Jewish, you kind of, you know, embodied the infidel. The Jew is the enemy at this religious school. But here you were, a particularized individual. It's often a lot easier to hate a whole group of people who aren't in your presence than it is to hate one individual who is.
Absolutely.
So what was their response to you as Jeffrey Goldberg, as an individual human being?
Well, fascination. I mean, they don't get a lot of Americans cycling through. They're a part of Pakistan or in Afghanistan. So they were curious. I mean, they were curious about a whole range of things, sexuality being one of the leading things. Part of it has to do with simple hospitality. I mean, Muslim hospitality. I'm sitting there, and I'm their guest, and they're not going to be rude to me. You know, one guy in particular, one of the teachers, didn't know I was Jewish and was ranting at one point about some conspiracy. Yeah, and I told him I'm Jewish, and he was apologetic. It was fascinating to see. He was apologizing and saying, you know, well, all people are, you know, created in God's image. It was actually a very hopeful kind of moment where he was sort of abashed that he was attacking my people without knowing that it was my people. So you're right. In the abstract, it might be marginally easier to demonize a group of people than it is when they're sitting right in front of you. That's a very American notion, of course. If we get to know our enemies, they won't be our enemies anymore. And a lot of Muslims don't ascribe to that theory. But it was an interesting moment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Goldberg. He writes about the Middle East for The New Yorker. You've been traveling through the Middle East for how many years?
On and off for 12 or 15 years.
Does it seem to you that anti-Semitism is on the rise? that there's more of it now, or that it's of a more extreme form than when you started writing about the Middle East?
You know what's different? I mean, the short answer is no. It's ubiquitous. What's different is what I see is a lot of people adopting very European ideas of anti-Semitism. I mentioned before, you know, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. These books are translated and sold on street corners, and I found my first copy of that in Jordan, I think. And it's interesting and terrifying, obviously, the grafting of these archaic and very pernicious European models of anti-Semitism onto Muslim culture and Arab culture that was, in comparison to Christian Europe, not very anti-Semitic at all. And that's what I've noticed more than anything else.
You know, your conclusion about the madrasa, the very orthodox Muslim school that you attended in Pakistan, was that the students, the boys in the school, were kept entirely ignorant of the world, and for that matter, largely ignorant of everything but one interpretation of Islam. You describe them, therefore, as perfect jihad machines.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that they go through an extensive process of brainwashing. And, you know, it's interesting. The students from this school, in addition to staffing the top levels of the Taliban, also make up some of its foot soldiers. And at key moments over the last 4 or 5 years, as the Taliban was fighting the Northern Alliance, a call went out to the madrasas of northern Pakistan, of the Northwest Province, and in Quetta, also Balochistan, that the Taliban needs help. And so hundreds of students at a time would be dispatched to the front. And they, from everything I heard, went entirely willingly to in many cases, their slaughter. So it was a very, obviously, a very effective place to indoctrinate these young men into the cause.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's writing a book on the Middle East. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid about reaction in Pakistan to the video released yesterday by the Bin Laden Organization and to the American bombing of Afghanistan. Also, we continue our conversation with Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Goldberg. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's writing a book about the Middle East. American TV viewers are starting to see a lot of the Arab news station Al Jazeera. It's a TV station that's considered to be the CNN of the Arab world.
Right.
And it's through Al Jazeera that the bin Laden videotapes have been released. What are your impressions of that TV network and, you know, both what it broadcasts and the impact those broadcasts have?
Al Jazeera has an enormous impact. It's really quite astonishing. It's one of the reasons that the Palestinian uprising of it's one of the main reasons the Palestinian uprising of the last year has so inflamed Arab opinion from all you know, from Morocco to Yemen to Iraq, because that station is showing over and over again footage of Israeli soldiers attacking Palestinians, and that has it really affected the way Arabs view that conflict. You know, I haven't seen it lately, and I don't know how there are spinning this this new conflict between America and Afghanistan. I know that Secretary Powell a few days ago asked the leader of Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based, to tone it down, and this caused a great deal of anger because Al Jazeera is nominally an independent station. So it was a strange request put to the leader of Qatar by Powell.
So the broadcast that you have seen, and I understand you haven't seen it in a while, though I should say here that CNN and MSNBC have been taking feeds from Al Jazeera.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see little snapshots of things. Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see. But what were your impressions of its journalistic fairness when you did see it?
Well, I mean, it's journalistic fairness isn't the right term. I mean, it's unabashedly pro-Palestinian. It's fairly critical of American policy in many manifestations of American policy, particularly on sanctions in Iraq, support for Israel, and that sort of thing. So, you know, in much the same way that the Arab world views CNN as hopelessly pro-American, I think Americans would see Al Jazeera as hopelessly pro-Arab. I mean, there's a pretty big gulf between, you know, in our understandings of journalistic fairness, let's say.
In the United States, there's a lot of belief in multiculturalism, and when there is and where there isn't belief in it, there's usually at least lip service that's paid to it.
Yeah.
So even people who don't truly practice a multicultural a way of seeing the world don't feel comfortable just casting aspersions on a particular ethnic or racial or religious group. Whereas right now, in more extremist parts of the Islamic world, it's perfectly acceptable to say, I declare war on Jews and Americans. You know, so
right.
I'm just wondering what it's like for you to go back and forth between those different mindsets.
It's interesting because there's more clarity on their side than there is on our side. I mean, we keep talking about this is not a war against Islam, but a war on terrorism. Well, terrorism is a tactic. Terrorism isn't an ideology. It's a tactic used by adherents to a particular ideology to meet their goals, to achieve their goals. I think we're kind of deluding ourselves. This is not to say that we're at war with all of Islam. There's a billion Muslims, and God knows I hope most of them aren't on Osama bin Laden's side, and I have no reason to believe that they are. But there are groups like Osama bin Laden's, and there are millions of people who support those groups, and they are in a very frank culture war with the United States. And we here in the U.S. are bothered by that idea, because we prefer to limit our anger to the 19 hijackers who hijacked those planes and to their immediate supporters and leaders. But people have to understand that it's almost condescending in a way to the Muslim world when we say this isn't about Islam. because for millions of Muslims, it is about Islam. And we have to understand that not, you know, this is a very sensitive area, but you know, in the multicultural worldview holds that everybody's the same. You know, that all religions believe in essentially the same thing. All people are good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they have different definitions of love and goodness and the responsibilities and requirements of religion. I'm not saying that of all Muslims, certainly, but certainly the ones where the Americans are currently bombing have that. And so we have to sort of confront a little bit more frankly the fact that these are people who aren't simply nihilistic, but have very specific ideas about the superiority of their ideology and the inferiority of our ideology and our culture. And if we do that, then we go a little bit further in the direction of understanding exactly what we're confronting.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker who's writing a book about the Middle East. Coming up, we call Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Ahmed Rashid, is a Pakistani journalist who has been covering Afghanistan for 20 years. He's the author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. In addition to writing for the Pakistani press, he's the Central Asia correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Daily Telegraph of London. This morning, we called him in Lahore, Pakistan, and asked him first for his interpretation of the videotape released yesterday by the Bin Laden Organization, in which a spokesperson promised that the storm of airplanes will not stop and said, America must know that the battle will not leave its land until America leaves our land, until it stops supporting Israel, until it stops the blockade against Iraq.
Well, it's really a call to war. I mean, I think, you know, he's come out of his hiding, as it were. He's come out of his secrecy and the veils that surrounded him, and he's calling for a jihad against the West and against the Muslim regime, such as Saudi Arabia's regime, which he considers as being as infidel as the West. And it really is a call which is supposed to kind of rouse the passions of Muslims around the world and to take up arms.
I think the intention also is probably to terrify Americans.
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, he's certainly done that, I think. And, you know, he's threatening more terrorist strikes. And he's also now we've heard today that, in fact, he has the Taliban have given him full freedom. They had said earlier that they had controlled his movements. Which was very doubtful anyway, but the Taliban have now totally committed themselves to his call for a jihad.
You're speaking to us from Lahore. What's the popular reaction to that tape that you've seen so far?
Well, Pakistan is very polarized. I mean, there is a minority support for Bin Laden, for the Taliban. People have been out in the streets protesting the American bombing of Afghanistan, criticizing the present regime. The vast majority of people, I think, are extremely upset with the Americans, but they're not in support of the Taliban, and they're not willing to go out in the streets, certainly, to demonstrate in favor of either the Taliban or Bin Laden. There is a lot of anti-American feeling, but generally, it's not being translated into support for the Taliban, except for the religious fundamentalist people who attend the mosques of these religious parties or study at their schools. So what you have is a kind of mullah student kind of demonstrations going on in a lot of cities. But these are small. The general public has generally not joined them.
I'm wondering how Muslims who aren't extremists, and that's the majority of Muslims, how they're reacting where you are in Pakistan to the call for Muslims to for all Muslims to participate in jihad. The spokesperson from Al-Qaeda said yesterday, jihad is the religious duty of every Muslim. And he seemed to be calling on every Muslim to do what they can to attack America.
Well, I think, you know, many sensible Islamic leaders and scholars have pointed out that, you know, not every Tom, Dick, and Harry can stand up and give a fatwa, that is an Islamic ruling, nor can anyone just stand up and declare jihad. You know, there's a means and a ways to do this. And for example, I mean, jihad in the past, during the Crusades, in the 13th, 14th century, you know, was declared only after a meeting of all the Islamic scholars of that country or region, which represented all the sects of Sunni Islam. And, you know, bin Laden is neither a scholar nor is he a preacher, nor does he have any kind of religious education as such. And, of course, the other big issue is, you know, what is jihad? And the Prophet Muhammad has described jihad in two ways. The greater jihad is the struggle of the self to be a good Muslim, to practice Islam fully. The lesser jihad is the jihad where you take up arms against foreigners who may have invaded your country. So, you know, the Prophet differentiated between these two jihads, and the fact remains that the greater jihad is a struggle within yourself.
I've been hearing a lot of people saying, why aren't Muslims who are opposed to bin Laden taking a more forceful stand against him and making sure that Islam isn't co-opted by his extremism? What are your thoughts on that and your observations?
Well, I generally speaking, I would tend to agree with you. You know, I think the problem has been that many of the Islamic regimes around the world are either authoritarian or dictatorial. They have their own problems with their people. Now, what, of course, bin Laden is doing is trying to appeal to the people directly and to overthrow, and that the people should mobilize and overthrow their regime. The problem in the Islamic world is twofold. I mean, you know, you have a terrorist problem, but you also have a problem of these regimes who, in many ways, have not seen the light, as it were, after the end of the Cold War in 1991, and gone in for economic development and democracy and greater freedoms and press freedom and issues like that. And these are not, you know, I mean, Muslims don't consider this as a so-called Western agenda. I mean, this is an agenda of the world. It's the agenda of, if you like, globalization, which cuts across, you know, religions and cultures. And many of these regimes really don't have their populations alongside them, and that is the problem.
Do you think the Musharraf presidency is in trouble?
Well, he, you know, Musharraf certainly, this is a military regime, and he's heading it, and it's certainly facing very severe problems because of this acute polarization in Pakistan. So far, I will say, despite the demonstrations and the pictures you've probably seen on television, he is holding the line. The demonstrations have been violent, but they've been very small by Pakistani standards. You've had several thousand people in the streets. You haven't had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets as yet. And he has reshuffled his army top command. He's got rid of some generals who were not supporting his alliance with the United States and the West. So he is in a stronger position. But, of course, it still remains very unpredictable, and that all depends on the nature of the war in Afghanistan. We don't know how long this campaign is going to last. What, you know, is Pakistan going to get inundated with 1 million, 2 million refugees? What happens, you know, inside the country? Will the Islamic parties actually succeed in bringing out the general public, which has so far refused to come out into the streets? So all these questions are very much there.
How would you describe the Musharraf presidency? I mean, he seized power in a military coup. Would you consider him a fairly democratic leader in terms of human rights and freedoms for the people in Pakistan, or would you consider him more dictatorial in that regard?
Well, this is a military regime, but martial law has not been declared. Now, we don't have the constitution has been abrogated for the time being. There's no parliament, and there's a great restrictions on political activity. But at the same time, there are pluses in the sense he hasn't interfered with the media. The media is as free as it was, you know, under democratic regimes. And he hasn't much interfered with human rights and the legal system. So it's a mixed bag, basically. But clearly, you know, with this present threat and the war going on next door, there are going to, and there have been already, you know, many arrests of politicians, Islamic leaders who've been protesting. You know, he has toughened up his act a lot.
Pakistan is a nuclear power. Are you worried about the possibility of nuclear weapons getting into the hands of extremists?
I don't think that is a real problem. I know it's been played up a lot in the West. But, you know, the nuclear program here has always been very tightly controlled by the army. This is a very hierarchical army under the, you know, it's been trained by the British and the Americans. The chief is the chief, you know, and if he reshuffles the generals, there's, you know, there may people, you know, other junior officers may be upset, but there's not a peep out of them. This is not an army which has had, you know, coups within from junior officers and things like that. So I think, you know, clearly the nuclear program has been kept under tight lock and key by the military. And what we have seen, of course, since September the 11th is much greater cooperation from the United States. In fact, there have been reports that the U.S. has actually supplied now for the first time a mechanism, safety mechanisms for Pakistan's nuclear program. The U.S. was unable to do this in the past because there were U.S. sanctions against Pakistan. But these sanctions have now been lifted, and, you know, the U.S. is also involved now in securing the nuclear program. This information has not been made public by either side because it's a kind of embarrassment in a way. But I think it kind of reassures at least the U.S. administration.
I think that the way what's happening now is being framed is that you're either for the United States and the coalition in the war against terrorism, or you're for bin Laden and the terrorists. From what you're saying, it really sounds like there's a lot of people who aren't for either. They oppose the bombing, and at the same time, they oppose bin Laden. Is that group that isn't happy with the United States or bin Laden being vocal in any way in expressing a third way?
Well, I mean, as in the United States, I think, you know, they are expressing indignation at the bombing, and they are the sort of incubators of a peace movement here, if you like. But it's a mixed bag in the sense that they're not particularly clear about how to deal with terrorism. They know they don't like the bombing of Afghanistan by the Americans and the civilian casualties that this is almost certain to create. But, you know, they are trying to be neutral, but this is a very difficult issue to be neutral about. The kind of polarization that you talked about was actually set by the Bush administration on the very first day when they told, President Bush told the world that either you're with us or against us. Now, what we've seen in the Muslim world, of course, in subsequent weeks has been many countries taking this neutral stance. Iran has condemned the terrorism but has refused to allow, back the American attack on Afghanistan. Many of the Arab regimes are taking a similar kind of position. They haven't given bases to the Americans. Even the Saudis, which is a very Saudi Arabia, which is a very close ally of the United States, has not allowed its command centers, which were built by the Americans, to be actually used by the Americans. Even though the American troops, you know, defended Saudi Arabia against Iraq in the Gulf War in 1991. So you do have now many Islamic countries taking, if you like, a kind of semi-neutral position. They have condemned terrorism, and they said that bin Laden has to give himself up, but they have not backed, if you like, the bombing of Afghanistan.
I'm wondering if you're hearing anything that you're finding disturbing, either in the streets or in the press, myths or conspiracy theories.
Well, yes. There have been incredible conspiracy theories in the local press here and in the Arab world about the bombings, that the World Trade Center was bombed by the Israeli intelligence, that 4,000 Jews in New York did not go to work that day because they had somehow been tipped off. So there were no Jewish casualties amongst the dead and wounded in the World Trade Center. That, you know, I mean, these are conspiracies that have done the rounds, and you know, I mean, they fit some of them are completely outrageous. Of course, they all are, and they've been, you know, widely condemned in other newspapers. So there is a kind of, you know, rush to judgment by many people and by the media here, who perhaps are sympathetic to the horrible murders of so many people in New York and Washington, but cannot possibly believe or want to believe that a Muslim could have carried that out.
Well, do you think the tapes that the Bin Laden organization has released in the past few days might convince skeptics that it really was possible for Muslims to have organized those attacks?
I think it's done two things. It has convinced many skeptics, because now, if you like, Bin Laden is out of the closet, and we know exactly where he stands. And this denying, you know, he denies everything. In the last 10 years, he's denied everything. But now there's no question of being able to deny it. But on the other hand, he's also raised many issues which go to the heart of Muslim feeling. He's talked about the Palestinian issue, and he's talked about Iraq and the children of Iraq. Now, you know, many of these issues, if you minus the threat to the U.S. and the fact that he's willing to carry out more terrorist bombings, many of these issues, of the other issues he talks about, go to the heart of many Muslim feelings. So, you know, it's been, I think, in the Muslim world, there's been a, you know, mixed reaction to what he's said.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist and the author of a book about the Taliban. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded earlier today with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He writes for the Pakistani Press and for the Daily Telegraph of London. We called him in Lahore. You've written a very good book about the Taliban. If the Taliban fall as a result of the military actions there that the United States has taken, what are the possibilities afterwards?
Well, I am very hopeful that the Afghan factions are going to get together and be able to set up a sort of an interim government which will include all the factions and all the ethnic groups. Now, this is a very long shot. It's been, you know, many people have tried to do this over the last 10 years of civil war since the Soviets left, and they haven't succeeded. But I think, you know, there are several factors now which are coming into play which could make this possible. The first is that there's total exhaustion by the population, and the faction chiefs know that, you know, they if they go in for another power-grabbing, land-grabbing kind of adventure, they're not going to get supporters to fight for them. They're not going to get the population with them. The other issue is that there's a chronic humanitarian crisis. Most Afghans are presently starving, you know, the faction leaders know that, I mean, the country has completely been, you know, driven down into kind of minus zero, if you like. So, you know, that is, you know, and it's a crisis that everyone sees. All the Afghans see that, and they all need peace. And what has been encouraging is that all the anti-Taliban factions, you know, are getting together and are calling for a peaceful settlement at the end of the war.
Any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing is, I think, you know, whether it's the peace movement, whether it is people in the United States who are supporting the present war in Afghanistan, I think the most important thing is to get Americans to be interested in this issue and to convince the ordinary American public and congressmen and legislators and people who really don't know very much about this part of the world that the U.S. has to remain engaged in this region once the war is over. It has to do certain things, help rebuild Afghanistan. It has to help mediate between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. But above all, it has to address the issue of the Middle East in a more a fair way. It cannot just be seen as a partner of Israel, as many Muslims see the United States as a partner of Israel in crushing the Palestinians. The Middle East problem is the core of the Muslim anger at the moment, and unless this is addressed in a more fair and equitable way, this Muslim anger against the United States, which will take many forms, I mean, not just terrorism, it will take many forms, but it will continue. And the U.S., you know, has to address the Middle East issue to be ensure that it can defuse this anger.
The impression I get is that the tone might be shifting now to a peace in the Middle East, from that to we don't want the state of Israel. You know, Israel shouldn't exist at all. That sentiment is getting more extreme against Israel.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, I think you know, the fact you've had an uprising in the Palestinian territories for so many years, the fact that there's been such an enormous radicalization, both of the Palestinians and the Israelis. I mean, the extremist Israelis now are more in number than ever before. There is a deep, deep polarization and radicalization on both sides of the divide. And it's going to need, again, I think, you know, international pressure and international engagement to try and defuse this.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist and the author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. He spoke to us earlier today from Lahore. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Therabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Chasing the Hawk, Looking for My Father, Finding Myself, a memoir by Andrew Sheehan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, traveling with the Mujahideen, we talk with journalist Robert Kaplan. His book, Soldiers of God, is about to come out in a new updated edition. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.